Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
What would you rather be? A federal employee whose work has been deemed essential, or a federal employee where they said, nah, you go ahead and stay home? It is getting to be, I'll tell you what, a blurry line. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Thursday, the 17th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. For the very first time on this broadcast, I do believe, ladies and gentlemen, superstar rapper Cardi B.
Trump is now ordering, as in summoning, federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid.
Fact check on that one. It's true. It's from her Instagram last night, and it comes as parts of the federal government have been shut down for almost a month. Come on, Cardi B, right? Hundreds of thousands of federal workers have been furloughed, meaning not working and not getting paid. Hundreds of thousands of others are working and not getting paid, as Cardi was saying. And that group is getting bigger because President Trump has started recalling thousands of furloughed workers, telling them to show up for work for free. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going with the changing definition of being an essential federal employee.
There are guidelines for who has to show up for work during a shutdown.
They can only call people back if they're in positions that, if not performed, pose a threat to life and to property.
Gregory O'Duden is a lawyer for the National Treasury Employees Union. The union is suing the Trump administration over how it's interpreting the law.
That exception really doesn't apply to the types of employees that they're calling back.
IRS employees are being brought back to process refunds. Is missing a tax refund a threat to life or property?
Determining who is essential is a kind of art, not a science.
Linda Bilmes is with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She says agencies and the administration decide exactly who is essential and
how essential a particular individual is changes if a shutdown is one day or 2 days compared with a month.
You might be able to skip, say, water inspections for a day, but a month? Plus, there's politics. Gordon Gray is with the American Action Forum.
The president more or less said, sure, say it's my shutdown. So it's in their political interest to try to minimize the impact on the public.
Gray says the executive branch is legally required to pay out tax refunds, so it makes sense it would bring the IRS workers back. The fact it will probably keep angry taxpayers at bay? A bonus. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Now, I know a lot of y'all don't care because y'all don't work for the government or y'all probably don't even have a job, but this shit is really f***ing serious, bro.
I mean, she's not wrong, right? It's 800,000 people. It's businesses, as we were telling you yesterday, looking for regulations that aren't coming. It's government data about the economy that is getting spottier by the day, about which this, by the way, we got our weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning because the Department of Labor is funded, for what it's worth. It was a pretty good number. First-time claims were down last week. The catch is, that report doesn't include federal government workers filing for jobless benefits. In Colorado, which has a lot of federal workers, 20% of claims last week came from furloughed federal workers. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that might just be the beginning.
Is that tall ice, not that latte?
Albert Romero filed for unemployment just after Christmas, about 5 days into the shutdown. He does administrative work for the U.S. Department of Commerce in Boulder, but I'm meeting him at Starbucks because his office is, yeah, closed.
I just wanted to get my name in the queue to ensure that I could meet my obligations. Whatever little income that I could get through unemployment would help definitely pay for the mortgage and car payment.
It's been nearly a month and still no check. The waiting period in Colorado is up to 6 weeks. Fortunately, Romero's wife just got a job as an accountant after being unemployed for months. He figures they can last till March without missing bills.
And I'm hoping that we're back before the 6 week waiting period so that we could just go back and do our work and get paid for what we do.
Kristen Flores, a federal research scientist based near Chicago, got her first unemployment check last Friday, 2 weeks after applying, and just in time, too. Her husband's job as a barista is part-time. They have two young kids, and
we've had one of those kind of almost comical, if it wasn't happening to you, years where the dishwasher breaks, we get into two not-at-fault accidents, but our deductibles still haven't been recovered, the basement flooded. It was just one thing after another, which really depleted the savings that we did have.
As the shutdown drags on, more workers are turning to unemployment insurance for help. And they should, says Michelle Evermore with the National Employment Law Project.
Unemployment insurance is there to help workers who've become unemployed through no fault of their own and their families, but also their communities, because people who receive an unemployment benefit spend that in the local economy.
Evermore says the benefit typically covers 30 to 50% of a worker's lost paycheck. They'll have to return the money after they receive back pay, assuming they can get it. Gabrielle Resch McNally is a researcher with the Department of Agriculture in Corvallis, Oregon. When we spoke, she had just faxed off a year's worth of pay stubs to the state unemployment office.
Because they can't confirm my employment, because my employer is not responding to these kinds of requests.
To qualify, she also has to prove she's actively job hunting.
It is odd, you know, because I do have a job that I would like to get back to, and I'm not trying to leave my job. So there's like it's complicated, and it's not without a fair number of kind of hoops to jump through.
Hoops she can't afford to avoid, because if the shutdown lasts much longer, she might actually need a new job. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Next federal payday, by the way, a week from tomorrow. Government contractors are facing a whole lot of financial uncertainty during this shutdown as well, some of whom won't be getting back pay. So why the 4.1 million federal contractors have become such a big part of the government workforce? We've got that at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, mostly calm until a late bump on what turned out to be exaggerated news of progress in trade talks with China. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of corporate stories now. Jewelry first. Signet, the company behind K Jewelers, Jared and Zales, reported some pretty disappointing holiday sales figures today. And not only were the holidays meh, but the company said there were fewer people in their stores overall and that they might have to actually shut some of those stores down. But there is more going on here than just jewelry sales, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Poor sales figures at a company like Signet are especially noteworthy because jewelry is supposed to sell well during the holidays, says retail analyst Sucharita Kodali at Forrester.
If you are not doing at least as well as last year, that is definitely problematic.
This is also a holiday season where consumer spending hit record levels. But when the economy is getting uncertain, Kodali says consumers will cut back on expensive jewelry.
If you see any pullback or you see any, you know, retraction in that category, it can be a harbinger for tougher economic times to come.
While there are plenty of signs the economy could be slowing, Paula Rosenblum at RSR Research says Signet's scale isn't helping. There are just too many Zales, too many Jareds.
And by their own acknowledgement, they have not created enough differentiation in any of them.
One way Signet and other jewelers try to boost sales is by offering financing or store cards. Bill Hardikoff at lowcards.com says store-branded cards are a good way for a retailer to make some extra cash, too.
If consumers carry a balance from one month to the next, that merchant is going to share in some of that revenue that's going to be brought in.
This week, Signet settled with regulators over a lawsuit claiming the company opened up credit cards for customers without their consent. Signet says it disagrees with the allegations. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Corporate story number two is housing via Seattle and Silicon Valley. Microsoft has promised a $500 million to help that city that is, Seattle, cope with its well-publicized housing affordability problem. And here in California, no stranger, by the way, to a housing crunch, Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed a similar tech partnership. Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains why government is looking at tech and why tech, it seems, is willing to spend.
California's housing crisis is so bad that families making almost $120,000 a year in the Bay Area can classify as low income.
California dream is at peril unless we address this issue. We can't continue to sell good weather.
Governor Gavin Newsom and housing advocates are increasingly looking to tech companies. Anya Lawler at the Western Center on Law and Poverty says the industry should help solve a crisis it's contributed to.
They've brought in tremendous economic growth. They've brought in tremendous population growth, tremendous workforce growth, but the housing growth simply hasn't been there. And so to me, it does make sense.
San Francisco has a new tax largely on tech companies to fund homeless services. Amazon helped block a similar tax in Seattle, but CEO Jeff Bezos then announced a $2 billion private donation for homelessness. Tech analyst James McQuivey says companies can duck political scrutiny by taking voluntary actions.
Everyone's looking around at these companies and say, wait, we're doing a lot for them. What are they doing for us? And it's proactive of Microsoft to say, oh, here's something we're going to do.
Plus, tech companies have a range of workers needing housing, not just high-paid programmers. But Sacramento State public policy professor Rob Wassmer says the industry could better use their money on lobbying government officials to make it easier to build housing.
But, you know, that has some political cost and ramifications that it's easier for them, perhaps, just to put the money forward.
He says every bit of money helps, but ultimately, government can't outsource the entire problem to tech companies. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
If you saw the Cardi B thing on Instagram, and quite possibly even if you didn't, there's been a meme floating around out there you've probably at least heard of. It's called the 10-year challenge. It's where you post two pictures, one taken recently, one from 10 years ago, just to show how much you've changed, I guess is the deal. Technology writer Kate O'Neill saw it, and instead of uploading her pictures, she wondered aloud on Twitter if the whole concept might just be being used for something not entirely innocent. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy. Great to be here. Thanks.
You chose not to participate in the 10-year challenge. How come?
Or you could say I participated in my own way.
In your own way. Okay. Yep. As I said, you tweeted your logic, but lay it out for me, would you?
Yeah. So I was looking at this trend and people sharing their pictures from 10 years ago and now, and recognized it as an opportunity that data researchers and data collectors, let's say, could gather all these contributions. And it could feasibly be used for something like facial recognition training for age progression. And I did not expect it to be quite so, interestingly received.
Yeah. So let me lay out a couple of things here. First of all, and as you point out in this piece, there are a gazillion pictures out there. What's the harm of a couple more, right?
Right. Everybody has a bunch of profile pictures for the most part. And I think most people would think, well, they're all out there. And for the most part, they're chronologically sequenced. So that's just available anyway. This is curated photos that you're specifically saying, this was 2008, this is 2018, or something along those lines. And you're selecting them for the purposes of, you know, saying that these are representative of you, or at least representative of the aspirational you, let's say. Mm-hmm. The other information that is attached to those images, like the creation date, any kind of modification date, that data would not necessarily be there once it had been uploaded and moved across platforms. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's scraped by platforms in the interest of privacy, ironically, as we talk about this now.
Yeah. Let us pause for a moment here, though, to check in with Facebook. You called them or you got a statement from them. What'd they say?
Well, in no way did I ever mean to suggest that this was directly started by Facebook. It was all just a speculative sort of hypothetical, meaning the picture is larger than Facebook, in fact. We're talking about is there's an overall trend that the more people participate in social media in these kinds of games and memes, the more opportunity there is for hackers or any kind of, you know, untoward agent, let's say, to gather this information and use it in ways that wasn't intended for.
Your concluding point in this piece is look, if we want corporate America and those gatherers out there of big data, of which this face recognition meme is one, this 10 years meme is one, if we want them to respect it, we have to respect our own data. Be smart about this.
That's the challenge here, is that we have to be responsible for safeguarding our own data and our own privacy. So how we look at things like the 10-year challenge, which could be perfectly innocuous in reality, but it's indicative of a larger pattern of memes and games like this that ask for participation in a particular way. And that's the kind of thing that I think we need to be a little bit cautious about in the going forward.
Kate O'Neill, writing in Wired about the 10-year challenge that you might have seen out there online. Her book on this subject and a bunch of other stuff is called Tech Humanist. Kate, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
the chocolate milk for the industry is seen as a flavor leader. It's a way to get kids drinking milk.
The agriculture department's got milk once again, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 0.6% today, 162 points, closed at 24,370. The NASDAQ grew 0.7%, 49 points, finished at 7,084. The S&P 500 added 0.7%, ticked up about 19 points, closed at 26,035. Stocks jumped after a Wall Street Journal report that the U.S. is considering easing tariffs on Chinese goods. That was walked back by the White House. Caterpillar nonetheless got a boost. Shares up 0.2%. So did Boeing, gaining just under 2% today. Earnings news, Morgan Stanley. Today was the last of the big banks to announce earnings. It said it stumbled a bit, missed expectations for the fourth quarter. Shares down 4.4%. Ouch. Told you Microsoft is going to lend $500 million to fund affordable housing in Seattle. Shares rose 0.7%. Facebook took down more than 300 fake accounts today that it says were run by a Russian news agency. Facebook up about 0.5%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We told you yesterday about how maybe drivers are relying on all the new semi-autonomous technology in cars right now, just a bit too much, not paying quite enough attention out there. The flip side of that coin is that the fully self-driving cars of the not-too-distant future might be just what the next generation of drivers, passengers, I guess, might be just what they need. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Juan Perez knows teenagers. He's been managing boys and girls clubs all over western Pennsylvania for years.
What's up, Eagle? What's going on?
And he's seen a lot of change.
When I was a kid, you got your license as the day you could. It was a rite of passage, you know, once you got to a certain age.
But for teens these days,
it's not a priority.
Perez says social media has seen to that.
A lot of their world, they're exploring right from their bed, you know, right from their fingertips on their phone, on a laptop, on a tablet.
The economics of driving have also changed since Perez was a teenager, especially for kids under 18. States now require more supervised hours on the road before you can get a full license. Driver's ed can cost hundreds of dollars. Then, once you have a license, there's insurance and gas and access to a car. Robert Foss runs the Center for the Study of Young Drivers at the University of North Carolina.
It's much harder for a teenager to be able to afford a car or pay for the cost of driving than was the case 20 years ago.
And it can be harder still for teenagers of color. According to the most recent data from AAA, 2/3 of white teenagers have a license by age 18, compared to 37% of black teenagers and 29% of Hispanic teens. Part of the driving decline is a result of the financial crisis, when it was harder for young people to get jobs. But, says Robert Fuentes with the Eno Center for Transportation,
now that we have seen the economy begin to recover, teen driving is ticking back up again, but it's still much less prevalent than it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Back then, nearly half of 16-year-olds had a license. By 2014, it was down to about 25%. 16-year-old Rodrigo Corral lives in suburban Pittsburgh. For him, it may as well still be 2014.
I am driving age. I just have not gotten my permit yet.
Corral would like to be able to drive to school and sports and his volunteer job here at the Boys and Girls Club. He's even saved up enough for a used car.
A car is a one-time thing, but meanwhile, insurance is almost about $300 per month for a driver under 18. And that's just so much, especially to take on at this age.
Juan Perez runs financial literacy workshops here and says getting a good job can become a bigger problem if kids delay driving too long, especially in areas without good public transportation, like suburban Pittsburgh.
There aren't many options for them to work locally, so it kind of limits what they can do. They could work at the supermarket that's down the street or the factory that's down the street, but there's no banking jobs, for example. There's no technology jobs.
So Perez encourages teens to get their permits even if they don't get a license until they're 18, when requirements change and insurance rates drop. That's what Rodrigo Corral's planning.
I would get the permit, and then I would keep the permit until I'm 18.
By that time, it may also be easier for Corral to clear another common roadblock, nervous parents, like Rodrigo's mom, Jane.
He's a big, heavy texter on his phone sometimes, so it kind of worries me that he might be on his phone or something while driving, and that's a big proponent for me to say, not right now.
So for right now, Rodrigo Corral will just have to endure one of the many indignities of being a teenager, getting carted around by mom and dad. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the North American International Auto Show and what the cars of the future might hold for the economic future of Detroit. Big Dairy is back in this country school cafeterias. The Department of Agriculture is throwing out some Obama-era school nutrition standards, changes that will help the American dairy industry a whole lot, which with tariffs and changing diets and a whole lot of politics, had hit kind of a rough patch. Peter Robison wrote about it for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The focus of this piece is about dairy, but I was caught by something that is up high in the story. I mean, it's like, you know, first couple of paragraphs or something. We are back in the American lunchroom wars, which started really with ketchup as a vegetable and Reagan and all of that, right?
Right. The idea of the food industries fighting over what kids eat in school is not new. You know, of course, people remember the fight during the Obama years when Michelle Obama started her Let's Move initiative,
right,
and the administration got behind the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which made massive changes in what's served kids to the point that 100% of foods sold in cafeterias needed to be whole grain rich. And that kicked off a debate that was industrial in that some of the big industrial food companies felt that these targets weren't manageable and were expensive. And that's what's come out most recently when the Trump administration took over.
Okay. So now get me to the dairy part of the fight, I guess. And I want you to do it via chocolate milk.
One big issue in the way the Obama administration approached chocolate milk was that if you serve chocolate milk, it has to be skim, not 1%, which seems like a minor change. Mm-hmm. But the chocolate milk for the industry is seen as a flavor leader. It's a way to get kids drinking milk and to continue drinking milk. 40% of the total consumption in the country is kids, and most of that is chocolate milk in schools.
Wow.
So after that rule came in, the industry has talked about a large decline in consumption that was happening in schools. So it was a top priority of the dairy industry to get 1% chocolate milk restored because it's a way to increase consumption.
Contextualize this for me, because dairy is having some issues in consumption because the really yummy stuff is high fat, right? And it's a lot of calories for like a half pint of chocolate milk, just for example. And it's struggling is too strong a word, but it's not having great days.
Well, what's happening with dairy is that doctors and others are questioning whether this idea that you need 3 cups a day is even important. So dairy, and it's also just a taste issue. I mean, there, I talked to the architect of the Got Milk campaign, and he said a millennial is never going to drink a cold glass of milk.
Oh, man. I mean, come on. Chocolate chip cookie and a cold glass of milk, they go together pretty well. I have those every now and then. The Trump administration looked at those Obama-era rules, and much like other things that the president doesn't like about the Obama era,
decided that they wanted to ease up, shall we say, on dairy, specifically Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue, right?
Right. Sonny Perdue has a background in agribusiness. He made his fortune in the grain business, and he also was a consultant to milk producers, which sold milk in numerous flavors to China. So the industry found a receptive ear in Sonny Perdue. And what was particularly concerning about the Obama targets was that the amount of sodium that kids were going to be allowed to eat was going to decline precipitously. It's already declined quite a bit. One consultant even described this as something of a cheese apocalypse to me. So in those two areas, in the sodium levels and in the amounts of whole grain, you saw significant rollbacks in what was planned.
Peter Robison, he's an investigative reporter for Bloomberg, writing most recently about the lunchroom wars in this country. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today. Remember we told you earlier this week about Netflix raising its prices? Yeah, look for more of same in the not-too-distant future. The company reported profits this afternoon, almost 9 million new paid subscriptions just in the October through December quarter. So the phrase you're looking for here, once again, is price elasticity of demand. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's up 0.6% today, picked up 162 points, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ grew 0.7%, 49 points, just a regular 49 points. The S&P 500 added 0.7%, picked up 19 points there. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Harem Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.